so much of self-awareness is just the ability to monitor and regulate in real time how you are responding to life and how the way you show up for life is landing on other people in the moment. We should ask ourselves, what does love require of me right now?
Hey everyone, in today's episode, I'll be discussing the Enneagram with best-selling author and Enneagram expert Ian Morgan Cron. The Enneagram is a personality assessment that can help cultivate more self-awareness and personal growth. I found it to be really valuable for both understanding myself, my kids, and my spouse, as well as my relationships with them. You can learn more about the Enneagram by visiting Ian's website. He's also offering our listeners 15%, 15, off of his Enneagram assessment and courses with the code ROOMFORTWO, one word. Click the link in the show notes for details. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
Hi, Ian.
Hey,
thank you so
doing?
Much for being on.
My pleasure.
Well, let me just introduce you to everybody and then we'll jump in with some of the questions and so on. But we're really excited to have you here, Ian. Ian Morgan Cron is a best-selling author, psychotherapist, Enneagram teacher, Episcopal priest, and the host of the wildly popular podcast Typology, which has over 20 million downloads. His books include The Enneagram Primer, The Road Back to You, which has sold over a million copies, the novel Chasing Francis, the spiritual memoir, Jesus, My Father, the CIA, and Me, The Story of You, an Enneagram Journey to Becoming Your True Self, and his newest book, The Fix, How the 12 Steps Offer a Surprising Path of Transformation for the well-adjusted, the down and out, and everyone in between. So I first learned really about the Enneagram listening to you on a podcast with Faith Matters. And I'd actually, my sister-in-law had given me a copy of an early book about the Enneagram maybe a decade ago, and it just went on my shelf and I never read it. And then when I heard you be interviewed, I really dived in and really found it to be a fascinating tool and one that I think personally is really superior to some of the other approaches, such as the ENTJ, the Myers-Briggs. Yes, exactly. Like, you know, those are all interesting to me to think about the ways that we tend to orient to making decisions and so on. But I've found the Enneagram to be a valuable tool in my work as a therapist and coach and teacher. So the reason we wanted to have you on is, as you might know, I host a podcast called Room for Two, where I work with real couples on marriage relationship issues around emotional and sexual intimacy. And the most recent couple, Brad and Kate, I just found myself bringing up the Enneagram to help think about what was going on with them. He was a three, but also had very high nine in his inclination. And she seemed like a four to me because she really had this sense of not feeling understood, often having a lot of emotions, wanting to talk about emotions that he as a three had really no interest in talking about. But she typed as a one. And so, which also fit, she had a lot of perfectionism and some OCD tendencies and so on. So anyway, but just in this discussion of working with them, a lot of listeners were like, what is the Enneagram? You know, they wanted to understand it better. And so I thought if we could have you come on, it could be really helpful to people, point them to your books and so on. But maybe we could just start with, if you could introduce listeners to what the Enneagram is, where it came from, and why you think it's a valuable tool for us in our development.
Sure. Well, thank you. Well, to begin, the Enneagram is a personality typing system that teaches there are nine basic personality styles in the world, one of which we gravitate toward and adopt in childhood as a way to cope, to feel safe, to get our needs met, and to navigate the new world of relationships in which we find ourselves. Very importantly, each of these nine types has an unconscious motivation or drive that powerfully influences how that type habitually and predictably acts, thinks, and feels from moment to moment on a daily basis. So that's super important information. I love the Enneagram. I've worked with Myers-Briggs. I've worked with Colby, Hogan, Berkman, you know, Strength Finders, DISC, you name it. I am in favor of any tool that can heighten your self-awareness and self-knowledge, right? I prefer the Enneagram over those other systems because it doesn't just explain what you do, but explains why you do it. Secondly, I like it because it honors the fact that the human personality is fluid and dynamic. It is adaptive, right? Who I am right now on this show is a lot different than who I'm going to be tonight when I'm sitting with friends at dinner in a restaurant. You know, like, as you know, the moment you start to run into rigid personality structures, that's usually a sign that there's some kind of pathology present or some lack of health present. And so the Enneagram reveals, oh, great, this is what you're like when you're not under pressure or when you're really doing well, this is what you start to look like. And when you're not doing well, this is what you start to look like. And here are the different choices you can make in these scenarios. Yeah. So I love it for all those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to concur with that because I remember when I was looking at the Myers-Briggs thinking, well, what type is Hitler? That is to say, they all seemed kind of positive, do you know what
right.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that is like almost no distinction in terms of how one is functioning. And what I really love about the Enneagram is it's got levels of development. And as you develop, what are the gifts in that type? How does the person become more flexible and solid within themselves, more differentiated in a sense, more able to use and express their gifts, mm-hmm. but also not rigidly in a way of coping, but also yes. what we do under pressure. In some ways, the nine archetypes are nine different ways that the ego can cope. It's sort of nine ways of sinning, in a sense, what the vice is in each type, because it's a way of trying to get control in a world that we feel vulnerable within. And if we indulge that vice too much, it keeps us stuck. But if we can lean into the virtue in it, then we can grow into our stronger self. And I love that path of development within it. You know, my mom was a two and she struggled more as a two. She tended to prioritize very much the needs of others. And she was there as a wonderful support. And she loved being a mother because it kind of fit with some of those gifts. But then after her kids left, I think that sense of who am I became kind of a crushing question because she was out of a sense of purpose and so on. But it was really wonderful for me to watch her grow into a more solid self as she got older. Certainly still a helper in her core, but a wiser one, more able to say no to things, more able to know her own mind and her own wishes, still in the spirit of the gifts that belong to a two. But I really could see how that progression happened without betraying the core of who she was, but being able to give those gifts in a richer way that blessed her and others. And so, so I love it. So in your book, The Story of You, you talk about the nine archetypes as ways that we tell the story of who we are, right? Those organizing meanings of our lives and who we are. And you explain that our spiritual development or our personal growth lies in changing our story, or maybe the way you say it is entering into a new story, and that's the genius of the Enneagram. So can you say a bit of what that means to you or how you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I like this. At the time that I wrote that book, I was very taken with this idea that we live narratable lives, right? Lives around which we write stories. And, you know, the stories that we wrote as little people, we often take with us into adulthood where they do not serve us any longer. Mm-hmm. So if a child hears implicitly or explicitly the message that they are only loved for what they do and not for who they are, then they may adopt an Enneagram 3 story of the achiever performer, right? And they drag that story into adulthood with them and they continue to obey its dictates, right? And even though it might meet some needs, but it's actually now working against them largely. And so maybe at the time I was thinking, gosh, you know, maybe the Enneagram actually just sort of describes nine stories. And there are variants, you know, infinite number of variants of these stories. but nine stories that seem to appear often in the population, and therefore we should pay attention to them, and mm-hmm. also see that the solution, therefore, to so much suffering is change the story. Like, mm-hmm. just like that idea, right? Like, I remember I had a client or a podcast guest, I can't remember which it was. I said, well, can you just tell me the story that you have told yourself about life and about who you are, that you've sort of just, can you just tell me about that story? And he told me this terrible story. I said, he goes, what can I do? What can I do? I said, change the damn story. And he's like, wait a minute, what? I said, you have the agency to change the story. Mm. Like, it's not cast in iron. It's not monolithic. It's vaporous. It's just a story.
Yeah.
Change the story, everything else changes. And so, you know, if you were a three, the story is no longer the world only values people for what they do, not for who they are inside. That's part of an old story. And so we just need to begin to dismantle parts of the old story. And it can take a minute, right? Because there's you might have a big house. It might take a minute to take it all down before you can erect a new one.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's, to me, the idea that was compelling in that for me was just, you know, how much we don't recognize that we are living into these narratives, that we're repeating them. They're organizing for us. And so it's actually scary to change the story, or it's even, it may feel entrapping because it's familiar and it's a story we know well. We keep telling it and telling it.
Yeah.
And I think that in some of the courses I teach, I'm often recommending to people to envision a different story, like a different, I am a person who does difficult things, kind of allowing themselves to envision another possibility is a way of growing into a broader, richer story.
Yes. Yeah. And I like that, because you actually sound like a little bit with what Carol Dweck does with, like with a growth mindset, right? We go from a closed mindset to a growth mindset. And in a way, that's a little bit of narrative therapy work, right? Is saying, okay, well, that was my old story. This is a new story. And again, it's not like we can take an MRI and see a story inside us, right? These are constructs or ideas that we develop to be able to talk about and work with our interior worlds. The Enneagram is that. Narrative therapy is that, but whatever it may be, IFS is certainly that. These are just really useful, interesting ways about that gives us a vernacular to talk about our inner experience of the world. And, you know, in that regard, they're very, very helpful. But you're right about one thing, and that is for many people, giving up their story is very hard because they've organized their whole identity around that story.
Yeah.
And that could be the victim story. It could be I'm the, you know, whatever story. There's a lot of stories out there to pick from, right? Yeah. And, you know, for many people, it feels like a death to give up a story. And in a way, it is. But for many people, they would rather stay with a story that's making them miserable than take the risk of finding one that's more beautiful and true. You know, the poet Auden had a great quote in one of his poems. He says, for years, I chose ruin over change. And it's like, that's what a lot of people do. They choose ruin over change.
And I think that willingness to change is an expression of faith, right? That's, you know, a lot of times we think faith is you just cling to things that don't make sense to you, but you just make yourself believe them anyway or something. We often will kind of use faith when what we really mean is fear. I think of faith as like, I'm willing to go through the transformation. I'm willing to lose the old self to find the truer self. But I think it's much scarier and much more disorganizing than we fully appreciate at times to really let ourselves step into a new experience of the world and who we are in it. I remember when I was a young adult and, you know, I'd kind of grown up in a family with low expectations for me as a female. Because, like, the biggest goal in my family was for me to get married. Okay. Now there's a lot of good things about that, but there was no view that I should go and get an education. In fact, if anything, I probably shouldn't. And so I remember when I was trying to kind of sort out, what did I really want to be? Who was I? What did I want? And I was doing this in a kind of prayerful meditation, like I was trying to sort out what was possible. I remember like writing out like what could be a story. I mean, I didn't have that language, but what was the story of what I could respect or desire? And I remember feeling like I needed to hide it because it wasn't just like I kind of imagined that God was okay with it. I wasn't sure that the people I loved, I felt I would be embarrassed if they saw it. So it's not just my own view of myself, which I think it was that, but I think it was like how I saw myself situated socially, you know, and that it would disrupt that in a sense of like, yeah, who was I in others' eyes? And I had, in some ways, I had to sort of take deeper ownership and sort of tolerate that I might disrupt their view of me in their eyes. And I remember thinking that was hard for me to do.
Yeah, well, of course it is. That's differentiation. That's individuation. Yes. That's the journey of saying, okay, these scripts that you gave me as a small child were very helpful and I appreciate them. But now I must surrender old scripts that no longer serve me. I am now a full-fledged adult of my own being.
Yes.
And therefore, I must find my own path. And that is a hard process. Some people actually never get it. Tragic.
Right.
Right. But, you know, it sounds like you did some work early on around that, and it was very helpful. And, you know, sometimes it takes a community of love and care to help us make that journey to a new story. You know, it's interesting, as you were telling, I've been part of 12-step communities for decades, right? I've been in recovery. Been around recovery world since the late 1980s. And I went to a meeting this morning and I often leave just amazed at the kind of unspeakably miraculous transformations that I see happen in people's lives regularly. Like it's not, every so often we see someone's life that's just completely changed. It's like, no, we see it a lot, right? And I was thinking, as you were just speaking, so much of what happens in those rooms is we challenge the stories that people have told themselves for a long, long time. And we give them a permission in a safe container in which they can begin to work those stories out toward eventually adopting a new one that will support, it will be life-giving rather than life-destroying, right? It's amazing. I was thinking about how important community is on that journey, like how important having others similarly who have walked it themselves or really want the best for you. And I'm always sad that people don't have very many places for that to happen.
Yeah. I went with a client to a 12-step meeting once. She was really reluctant to go. She'd never been. And I just remember sitting there in that room with people telling the most honest stories. And some were telling stories of transformation. Some were just there for the first time. It was so deeply spiritual. I mean, I can't tell you, like sitting there was like, oh my gosh, like the respect for the beauty that is in that room and what the hope that was in that room.
Yeah.
Even as people were telling some of the most challenging stories of loss and grief and regret.
You know, most of the depictions of 12-step meetings that you see on television are so bad and so error-filled, it's ridiculous. Because actually, most meetings, whether it's NA, OA, AA, whatever your A is, right, are filled with laughter. I go to meetings all the time, and they're hysterically funny. The things that people say, the honesty, the kind of the sometimes. So it's not like a bunch of people sitting around looking depressed, talking about not drinking or not taking drugs or not doing, you know, that is just not what it is there, which then highlights the presence of the divine, that God's in the mix. There's this kind of joy that suffuses the room, which tells me, oh, someone else is here because here we are, these 30 people that are a mess. And yet here we are. Finding life and joy and happiness and change. And I wish everybody could experience it.
Dr. Jennifer here. Through Saturday, all of my 2026 multi-day workshops and retreats are $200 off. This includes the Sex Worth Wanting retreat in June, the Art of Desire retreat in August, and the Art of Loving retreat in November. While this is an amazing offer, it's not an April Fool's Day joke, so click on the link in the show notes and use code JFF200 to save on any of these three retreats.
I think, you know, while the Enneagram can give us structure to think about who we are and maybe to better understand, like, how have I related to the world? What is the story I've told about who I am? You know, I imagine some of the questions that came in from listeners was, you know, can the tool be used in a deterministic way? Like, sometimes my daughter will say, like, but I'm a four. And I'm like, you aren't a four. You are much more than a four. I mean, you tend to do the world in a four way, but you're more than a four. What are your thoughts about that? If we can use it to almost see ourselves as stuck in a way of relating?
Yeah.
And yeah, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I'm an Episcopal priest. So I come from a particular tradition. And for me, your personality causes you problems when you over-identify your personality with who you are. Your personality is just basically a collection of adaptive stratagems that you came up with as a young person to navigate the world, right? Part of it, probably genetics. Part of it, we don't really know, right? Like, some of it's genetics, temperament, disposition. There are so many different opinions on personality theory and personality development. I mean, whatever. For me, the bottom line is that you are not your personality. You have a personality, but it is not who you are, right? As a person of faith, and a person very drawn to the sort of the contemplative mystical tradition of my own faith, I would say that there is a you behind your personality that is maybe alien to you, but that's who you really need to get in touch with. Merton would have called it your hidden wholeness. Richard Rohr might call it the immortal diamond. You know, it's this true essential self that is free of all the junk of personality. It's just who you are. It's that pure expression of your, call it your Christ self, your, you know, whatever self you want to call it, right? Yeah. This God self inside. I like the Enneagram in part because it doesn't actually describe who you are. It describes who you aren't. It's like, oh, by the way, you're a four, but that's not actually who you are. That's just these patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving that you know, you approach the world with. But what if there's a truer you behind that that's even more interesting and exciting to know? And that's interesting.
I love that. Yeah, like the ego and the rigidity and the kind of narrowing, like a three, I must achieve. It's like a narrowing of who you are out of fear, out of the ego.
Yep.
And you're so much more than that to be human. Yeah.
So much more beautiful, so much more interesting. And your personality can be wonderful and good and also crazy if it gets off the leash and does dumb stuff, right? And you just get to learn about machinations of this thing and learn how to be a person who knows how to exercise good self-leadership, good self-governance, try to live out of the best of what you got, and, you know, trying to keep the rest of it properly disciplined, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Or one of the critiques of a friend of mine was saying, you know, yeah, but isn't it a little bit like a parlor game? Because anything you read, it's a little like a horoscope. And my response to that was a little bit like, well, we are all of these things. Like, we can all do pride. We can all do avarice. We can all do, you know, and we have all those gifts on some level. But I think we tend to have preferences and rigidities. And to grow is to broaden and deepen those things. So, you know, we're all those things. And I love that, the uncovering. Can you say a little more about how you think about, let's say you are a one. You know, how does the one utilize the virtue of the one, or how does the one think about where they need to push themselves, or any number for that matter?
Yeah. Okay. So let's use the one as an example. All right. So, the one is, I call them the improvers. Lots of people call them the perfectionists. They have an unconscious need to, perfect themselves, others, and the world. Okay. They also have a need to be right and to avoid fault and blame. So there's how what is it that's driving so many of the characteristic features of the one? It's that, right? Now, their passion or deadly sin is anger, but it really is more like resentment. And the resentment is that other people are not as concerned as the one is with fixing all the errors in the world that the one sees, right? And so the one is looking at everybody else going, why are you slackers not doing everything? I'm busy all the time trying to fix the world, okay?
Yeah.
And you're not as concerned about it as I am. And I'm just getting a little huffy about the fact that everyone's having a good time. They're down at the beach, you know, playing volleyball. Here I am. Yeah. You know, organizing the sock drawer, doing the dishes, and nobody else is taking life. Here's one, as one said to me, why am I always the only adult in the room? Right? Okay, so there's the resentment. Now, what's the journey? The journey is the virtue that is the antidote to resentment is called serenity. Now, what is serenity? God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot fix, help me to fix the things I can and give me the wisdom to know the difference and help me to live at peace with this idea that I live in a perfectly imperfect world. And nobody has pinned the star on my chest to fix everything. And maybe there's more than one right way to do stuff. It's not just my way or the wrong way. Maybe there's lots of ways to load the dishwasher. Maybe there's lots of different ways to teach your kids X, Y, or Z, you know, to be more spacious, right? So what I'm trying to highlight here is that each type has a passion. Each type has a virtue that it's working toward. This is the growth path. Each one has an unconscious motivation. So the more you're aware of it, the more you're working with it, then the more transformation you'll enjoy.
Yeah, I love that. So you're like, you're trying to take the rough edges off your virtue because you want your attorney or your surgeon to be a one, you know, you want them to be detail oriented. There's a lot of gift in that ability to think about what's just, fair, what's right, what's particular, but you're working with you're easing that so it doesn't become relentless in its sort of demand of others. And so you're pushing into, I need to be able to hold those strengths, but soften. That's my journey into more wholeness.
Yeah. Listen, you know, one way to think about your Enneagram type, and there's a lot of different ways to think about it, is that every single one of them is a trauma response. It's actually just a response to very early trauma, developmental trauma, right? And these are the ways that we figured out, oh man, in order to survive within this little ecosystem of mine, this is who I'm going to have to be. And this is who I'm going to have to be to get my needs met. And this is who I'm going to have to be to function. And getting free of that doesn't mean that a lot of the gifts of your type are going to, you know, go away. It just means that you're going to be less constricted and playing out the machinations of your type to the nth degree, which, you know, won't serve you any longer, right? So when the one can be like, you know, okay, when everything's not perfect, but, you know, they have high standards. Well, good, have high standards. Just don't be tyrannized by them and don't tyrannize others with them.
Right.
You know, it's just, like learning to hold these things a lot lighter.
Yes. Exactly. You know, one of the things sometimes when I've read or listened, I mean, there's capital T trauma, and then there's your bumping into the world, and it's co-constructed in my view. It's not just a parent did something, otherwise you would have turned out great. Maybe this is because I'm a parent and I'm like, it's not all the parent's fault, but anyway. But there's also dispositions. For example, you know, my son is on the autism spectrum. He's a 5. You know, I think he experienced the world from an early age as demanding for what his disposition was. So he's very much in the cerebral. He pulls into inside of himself. He will interact socially for a little bit, then he'll go, you know, away from. So it's also like who you are and how it interacts with parents and the world and so on. Do you agree with that? Or what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. I think there's a real mystery about where personality comes from. And I know, I think it's a conflation of many things, right? You have cultural forces. You have family forces. You have genetic forces. So is it nature? Is it nurture? Yes. I mean, what percentage? Where does it lean? I don't know. And maybe it leans differently for everybody. What I think we can know for sure is that these are, you know, adaptive strategies that help us navigate the world as successfully as we can in the situation in which we find ourselves. Now, when you talk about autism and being a five, those are two very separate things, as you know. Mm. And I'm always hesitant, you know, so sometimes, not all the time, we take what's often a personality thing and pathologize it. Sometimes people will say, oh, he's so ADHD. And I'm like, okay, maybe. And if he is, then let's give him Adderall or Vyvanse or whatever they need. Yeah. But let's, what if they're just a seven who needs more time on the playground?
Right, exactly. Right?
Or they're a nine that whose attention is very diffuse and kind of all over the place. What if what we're doing is just medicating kids with like,
100%.
Like labeling them and stuff. Now, I'm not saying, listen, I'm a therapist. I'm all in favor of medication if it's required. Yeah. I'm all in favor of diagnoses. But I think there's a, you know, you
can
go through, right? It's like sometimes it could be autism, right? Or sometimes I've seen a lot of kids who I just thought were fives.
Yes.
You know, they didn't quite, you know, meet the criteria for autism, but they sure looked a little bit autistic because they were kind of, it might be that, you know, failure to connect, you know, sort of an emotional aloofness, a kind of awkwardness socially. But a lot of times in schools, man, they're just so quick to bang with a label. And you're like,
put the label. Exactly. It's like, how much does a label help you get the resources you might need versus it's an over pathology of difference. Like Temple Grandin, who is a woman with autism herself, said the world needs all kinds of minds, or the body of Christ metaphor is exactly that you're going to see and understand things in a particular way. I mean, I actually really love talking to my son about politics because he isn't so pressured by the social pressures. And so he's often has a very unique perspective on things or social situations because he doesn't get as influenced by what other people want from him. And so it makes him a really interesting person to discuss ideas with because of the autonomy in his thinking, actually. And, you know, so yes, I think we need all kinds of minds. And trying to make everybody be a three, for example, because America loves threes is not good for us.
That is true.
So a listener asked if the Enneagram has any particular relevance for understanding marriage dynamics. And if you think so, how is it helpful?
Oh, yeah. My gosh. I've seen the Enneagram save countless marriages.
Yeah.
literally save them because people are having these sort of scales falling from the eyes, experiences of like, oh my gosh, that's who you are? Oh, I didn't know. You know, even if I've been living with you for 20 years, my gosh, I had no idea really what was going on inside of you. And vice versa. The cool thing about the Enneagram, what does it do? It gives two people in a relationship a vernacular with which they can talk about their inner worlds. They can read about each other's inner worlds, and they can suddenly, the ways that they used to be are not viewed any longer as being personal. Like, oh, wait a second. I thought this was just unique to you. It's like, no, there's a bunch of people just like this who do pretty much the same thing Bob or Jane does, you know? And now you can have a conversation about stuff and it's no longer finger pointing in terms of the feeling behind it. I'm a four. My wife is a nine. Oftentimes, you know, I may, in a particular moment, you know, you got to be careful, but I might say, I'm just picking up some nine energy right now. And I'm wondering what's happening. And it's like, well, she's already agreed she's a nine. We both agree on that. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm just picking up on something. It's less threatening. It feels less like a personal attack. Now it's just a conversation about this, you know, it's like this, let's talk about that thing that's in the room with us right now. And it's just helpful on so many different levels. It can give you a sense of humor about each other. It gives you a way of just normalizing this conversation around, well, this is how I see things, or this is how I have seen things, and here's how I have to grow. And here's how you can help me grow. All right, let me give you an example of this. All right. So my wife and I are both in our 60s, and we've had just a really wonderful life together. We've been together 40 years. And 2 years ago, I came home from a trip, and my wife, who's a nine, I opened the door, I walked in, and almost the first thing out of her mouth was, "I have decided that I am going to graduate school to become a counselor with a specialization in addictions, and I've already applied, and I've gotten in, and I'm going." And I went, what? like, what? Where did this person come from? Like, what? When did this? Like, it was so out of left field, right? Okay.
Yeah.
But here's what I know about nines. It took my wife a long time to figure out what her path was. And when it came and she said that, I knew enough about the Enneagram and about my wife that I knew in that moment that the last thing I could do was in any way, shape, or form push back on that dream. That I needed to say to her, "I am so happy. Rock on. We'll make it work. We'll make this work financially. Whatever it takes, we're going to make this work." Because when a nine shows up like that and says, "This is what I want. This is who I am. This is what I'm doing," you need to get the you know what out of the way.
Yeah.
Because that because that's really a big spiritual moment for them, right? Now, I'm a four. I could do that every week.
Sure, exactly.
You know, here's my new plan. You know, it's like for finding meaning and success, you know, in the world. But when she did it, so it gave me insight. The Enneagram, there's a situation where it just gave me immediate insight into something that I could have botched badly had I not known the Enneagram.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm married to a nine too. And that's lovely, because the nines, just for people that aren't as familiar, the nines' gift is this ability to see through like all nine perspectives. They can see complexity. They can see the other side of any argument. My husband has always got the other side for me. Sometimes I appreciate it. Sometimes I don't. But also that can be the hindrance, is that you've got so many, like finding what is my view? What do I think? What do I want is hard, because you can always kind of hold all the other.
Well, the other reason is that, what's your type again?
I'm a three.
You're a three. So your husband, I mean, this often happens, right? Your husband, is he a self-pres nine?
I think so. That's what I think he is.
So if that's the case, then, you know, he just married a much larger personality than his. And you have stronger opinions, stronger viewpoints, stronger ideas, stronger, you know, desires in lots of ways. His are dialed down. And so he just, you know, figured out, if I merge with yours, then, you know, I can just kind of like skate on by. Right. And it's like, that's actually pretty unhealthy. But when you know that, then when your partner starts showing up with the virtue of right action, which then is the antidote to the passion of sloth. And when you see that show up, you want to applaud that. You want to like cheer when your nine spouse or partner does that. And again, it's like, it just gives you insight that, you know, would normally take you so long to get your hands on, you know, it could take you decades to figure that. I wish I'd known all this stuff in my 20s, you know, but it would have helped.
Yeah. 100%. Because, you know, one of the things I talk about is that in Eros love, when we fall in love, we're often drawn to an opposite personality, or, you know, or like the mystery in the other. And we feel that sense of communion and connection and wholeness, like you, this person that does the world so differently than me. And then you get married and then you're like, what's the matter with you? Why don't you have goals? And, you know, and John's like, why do you want to do things all the time? Why don't you just like settle down and just be here? So anyway, but I think it's absolutely true. The more you can like see, no, I chose this person. They do the world differently. There's so many gifts there, so much for me to learn and benefit from in understanding and knowing their mind and accepting them rather than trying to change them. And I think that's when you really start to become a couple, in the sense that there's no longer trying to change the other person, but value and be able to understand them, even if there's plenty of good humor in it at times.
Right.
Yeah, it's great. Do you think it's common for people to marry the same number? I mean, I haven't seen that very much, but somebody asked that question in the group. Do you have any thoughts?
I've seen certain types do that. It's not as frequent as people might think. And I think there's, you know, opportunities and risks when you marry someone of your own type, right? If you were married to a three, like yourself, then then the two of you may give each other a pass on working 70 hours a week.
Yeah, right.
You might give a pass when you see the other not being authentic, because you're like, yeah, go, yeah, rock on, man, keep going. You know, it's but so sometimes being married to your own type runs the risk of the other person, you know,
keeping each other blind.
Yeah, keeping each other blind. Versus the nine who may look at you and go, you need to slow down. Like, you're going way too fast. Whereas your partner, if they were three, may not be able to do that, right? I think any two numbers can have a wonderful relationship. There's no bad combination of numbers. It all just comes down to how self-aware and active are each member of the relationship doing work on themselves. If they're growing in self-awareness and they're growing in love and compassion and kindness, they're doing the work required to do that. Any combination can be quote unquote successful, however you choose to define it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, because I think self-awareness just increases our agency. It allows us to choose better, choose more wisely. Yeah. And it's refusal to see ourselves or to acknowledge our blind spots that really interferes with peace in a relationship and with ourselves.
Yeah. And I think so much of self-awareness is just the ability to be able to monitor and regulate in real time how you are responding to life and how the way you show up for life is landing on other people in the moment. Oh, I love this question. Periodically throughout the course of a day, I think we should ask ourselves, what does love require of me right now? Sometimes people go, I want to know what God's will is. Like, okay, fine. Just ask this question. What does love require of me right now? Whatever that is, chances are that you're going to be aligned with whatever God's up to anyway, if you do that. And so, you know, if you find in the moment that as a three, you're showing up too busy for your child and your brain is going too fast and you're working too hard and you're treating them like a project versus a person. And maybe you feel like you're noticing that maybe something that your spouse does is embarrassing to you because it makes you look bad socially, you know what I mean? Or less attractive, whatever the case is, you're just in real time able to observe these feelings and thoughts and being able to just say, you know, I don't have to do that. I'm going to let my husband be separate from me. And if he burps at the dinner table, I will mention it to him afterwards that I don't think that's helpful. But at the same time, you know, that's for him, not for
me,
you know?
That's right.
And so you just, you know, being able to observe.
It's the moment of rewriting the story that I want to be bigger than that. I want to be somebody buffled to everybody's opinion or whatever it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Last question before I let you go. The couple that I worked with, again, she tested as a one and she told me she had a lot of four. I know four is a line of regression, so I don't know if that was it, but she definitely had this feeling of being misunderstood. She's married to a three who I would say she felt some competitiveness with because he had a persona that was very likable and drew people to him. But I think she felt sort of like maybe like there wasn't enough emotional connection and time for her. And she felt like he wouldn't maybe reform in the ways that she wanted or be the kind of person that she wanted. So any thoughts you'd have in general about how you help that couple? And it's kind of a big question, but just what any general advice about that dynamic and where they might each grow?
Golly, it's certainly a big question. I mean, in terms of growth, what does the three need? I am not going into detail here. They need to slow down. They need to be more authentic about particularly telling the truth about feelings, not just results. They're going to have to learn how to admit when they're scared, when they're tired, when they're unsure, rather than always having the look of confidence. Like, I got this, right? Letting the one see the real you. The one will fall in love with authenticity more than success, right? Mm. That for the one, they got to loosen the inner critic. They have to say what's right as well as what's wrong in any given moment. They have to make space for imperfection. They're going to have to, you know, appreciate effort, not just correctness. They're going to have to open up their mind to this idea, as I mentioned earlier, that their way is not the only way of doing something correctly. And letting go of kind of rigidity, black and white thinking, etc. So the best thing that any two couples in a relationship can do is their own work. So do not try to fix the other. The moment you start getting into the other person is my project, yeah. As ones, by the way, can sometimes do if they're not careful. I meet so many ones married to nines that are trying to fix the nine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to get these nines together. You know, it's like, and I'm like, well, you're about to have 40 years of unhappiness or of frustration. And, you know, again, their job is to work on themselves and then bring the product of that work to the relationship, right?
Yeah.
And not try to fix the other. I think these couples grow when they learn that, you know, relationship is not a performance. It's not a job. It's not a project. It's a context in which to be human. And, you know, 3-1 can be a great combination. But again, to the degree that each member of the partnership is doing their work and is growing in self-awareness, right? If they're not careful, a 3-1 combination could become very driven. Both have vulnerability toward workaholism. So they have to be very careful. And also, the one has high standards, very high internal standards, and they want to conform others in the world to those standards. A 3 has very high regard for excellence. And sometimes they get confused with ones, but they're not ones. Because they're also willing to cut corners sometimes to get the win. And the one looks at that and is like, nope, no can do. That you may not break the rules to get to the finish line. And the one's like, can we not be pragmatic? And it's like, nope, we got to follow the rules. So again, these can be wonderful combinations. And, you know, there's lots of resources out there for reading up on different types and relationships. And again, I think that 3-1 combination, again, could be great. They just have to make sure they're doing their own work. The one in particular has to make sure they're not turning a 3 into a project.
Yeah.
And
I think in this couple, the 3 had his own version of trying to
make the one
know, be enough so he could feel like he was succeeding in the marriage, in a sense, like doing things that would make her feel okay. You know, so I think he had his own version of kind of enmeshment.
And codependence.
And codependence, exactly. I think that is really the work of relationships is sorting out, you know, back to the AA mantra of figuring out what's mine, what isn't mine, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Well, I mean, right? I always tell people, you know, you can be okay, you know, like, because the codependent posture is, in many ways, you could put it like this. It's, I can't be okay unless you're okay.
That's right.
Right.
Exactly.
And we could sometimes also put that as, I can't be okay unless you're okay with me.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's both of those things. And I'm like, it is so much freedom when you realize, oh, I can be married to someone who's not okay. And it's not, I'm not responsible for their happiness. That's not my job.
Exactly. Right.
I need to get back in step back into your hula hoop. And stop, you know, trying to fix this for everybody else, because otherwise it's just gonna make you crazy.
Yes, can't love somebody if you feel like their limitations are your project. Meaning, if I have to make you okay, it's hard to love them because you're gonna feel anger towards them and so on.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's such a mess. Right? Like, but I always think, speaking of 12 steps, I don't know anybody who could not benefit from a Codependence Anonymous meeting. I mean, I feel like everybody should go to CODA. If you can't go to Al-Anon because you don't have a qualifier, go to CODA. Because it's just like, you get so much from it.
Yeah.
It's just a good course on how to be in relationships.
Yep. So good. Okay, Ian, thank you so much. Before we go, I just want you to tell people about your courses and what your offerings. And I think you also, Christy told me that you're offering a 15% off deal for anybody who wants those. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. So if you go to Ian Morgan Cron, IanMorganCron.com, you'll learn about all kinds of stuff that I have there. But one of the things is my Enneagram assessment. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars creating a valid, reliable psychometric instrument to figure out type. We did it with a research psychologist and their PhD students. I mean, it was like a real thing. It's not one of these little like stupid like personality quizzes that, you know, are basically an email grab and then they just mislead people, tragically. And so that's there, and you get a 15% discount if you use the, I think the code is room for two.
Great, excellent.
And then, you know, I have courses, introduction to the, you know, one level is like sort of like, you know, intro to types. And then another one is discovering you. And then another one is about the Enneagram in the workplace. So there's a number of different courses that are available and opportunities to learn more about coaching with me and that kind of stuff is there too.
Great. Awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule.
So super fun.
All of us. So, okay. Thank you so much, Ian. And I'm wishing you all the best in all of your projects and adventures.
Thank you. You too, Jennifer. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.